The site of Saudi troops being transported in a column of armoured personnel carriers over the causeway linking Bahrain prompted many to say they were witnessing a foreign occupation of the tiny island state. Others said it was merely GCC countries banding together and showing solidarity. But what do you think? Tune into the agenda for the real facts. When more than 1,000 Saudi troops rolled over the causeway and into Bahrain, many saw this as the start of a foreign occupation on the tiny island state, which has been in turmoil ever since pro-democracy protesters occupied the iconic Pearl Square. The shock arrival of Saudi forces was followed by a contribution from other Persian Gulf states. And since then, the regime set about demolishing the Pearl statue, which became a universal human rights symbol for the struggle of the protesters who had camped there for many weeks demanding democracy. In that time, scores of protesters were seriously injured and some killed during clashes as tensions rose in the world's largest oil-producing region. Now living under martial law and curfews, there are those who are wondering who is really in control. Some international observers are asking why the GCC sent in forces to support a fellow royal ruler, but could not do the same for the anti-Gaddafi fighters in Libya. What the arrival of foreign troops also revealed was that the GCC countries could act swiftly and without the approval of the United Nations when deploying forces, and nor did they need to rely on Western support for help. This is the sort of help which would have been welcomed weeks ago by those rising against the tyranny of dictators in the Arab world. Today's agenda asks the question, Bahrain. Is it under foreign occupation? Well, the iconic Pearl statue has gone, but the protesters certainly have not, and they seem determined to demand the removal of King Hamad and insist on the introduction of real democracy. Joining us today to discuss the issue is pro-democracy campaigner Saeed Shahabi, who has been fighting for decades for reform with the Bahrain Freedom Movement. It was a lonely struggle at times, but just recently the ranks of support has grown, bolstering his hopes of an Arab-style People's Revolution. Joining him is Rupert Nicol, a security and media analyst and former Ministry of Defence spokesman for the UK government. He believes that the West is faced with a dilemma over choosing which dictators to support and which revolutions to back. And completing today's trio is agenda regular, American-born Charlie Wolfe, who thinks that military intervention in Bahrain was necessary. But I'm going to start with you first, Rupert. You've said that you would have told the Saudi to stay out. Well, why would that have been?
As you've already said, it's a question of consistency. Who do you support and who do you not? Is this another democratic protest to be supported, which it certainly looks like, or is it a revolution to be suppressed? Which side are we on? Which side are the Saudis on?
Well, which side is Britain on? I mean, you used to speak for the government in MOD circles.
Yes, but, well, in this instance, it's quite clear that who our supposed allies have been in the past, it's a question of who they're going to be in the future.
Right. Do you think that's a bit of a cop-out remark, Saeed?
Well, I think this is a Machiavellian approach to the situation. I believe that Britain should have become faithful to its principles, and that democracy is democracy, whether it is in Libya, in Egypt, or in Bahrain.
That's exactly what I was trying to say. Personally, I think that that if we suppose that this is an uprising of democracy all over the Middle East and North Africa, we should be supporting it wherever it happens.
But it also must be said, and I throw this in slightly as devil's advocate,
yes,
that a state's primary goal, of course, is to defend its own interests.
Yes.
And, you know, for instance, we have the Fifth Fleet based in Bahrain. Hmm. The Saudis, for instance, is an old ally and an interest of the United States, you know, speaking from an American standpoint. Even Egypt, there are many that are arguing it was a mistake for Mr. Obama to throw Hosni Mubarak under the bus. Say what you will about Hosni Mubarak, he is still been an ally of the United States for 30 years, and the country has been an ally and an interest of the United States. So there are many ways one has to look at these things.
But are you putting human rights aside?
No, not at all. I'm not saying that, but it's also said that we can't, just based on human rights interventions, go into any and every situation we want. Now, I think that in the case of Libya, we are, and I think it's a pretty clear-cut exception to the rule. We also know, I think, that Mr. Gaddafi is an outcast. Mm. He is a terrorist. He was behind the Lockerbie flight. He was behind the bombing of the U.S. barracks, etc. Yeah. So I think it's a pretty clear-cut.
But we have already settled all these issues with him. You had already.
Oh yeah, no, yeah. I agree. In many respects, you're right. I mean, I'm just adding that is just on top of. I think based on the current situation, it is an extraordinary case. Whereas in the others, I think Mr. Obama. A lot of this, and yes, I'm not a fan of Mr. Obama. I sit on the other side politically. But all that aside, I think many on both sides of the aisle in America are agreeing the United States unusually has not shown leadership, and it goes back to starting with Egypt by essentially throwing Mr. Mubarak to the wolves instead of through the back channel.
Well, it took some time before he made that decision.
It took some time, and then he wasn't on top of it, and then he instinctively just threw Mr. Mubarak to the wolves. And so I think what's happened here, in a nutshell, looking at Bahrain, is the Saudis are saying, well, wait a minute, and the Bahraini monarchy, royal family is saying, wait a minute, our ally doesn't seem to be consistent anymore in standing up for its allies and interests.
That's exactly what I was trying to say.
So therefore, that's why the Saudis are saying, well, if America ain't going to be counted on,
somebody else will.
That's one of the great dangers.
But I thought the United States would have changed a little bit of its policy after Iraq in 2003. And this is when, at that time, shortly after the invasion of Iraq and the war and the downfall of Saddam Hussein, the Congress formed a committee to look into one question: why does the Muslim world hate us? This is what they went and they investigated, and they met us here in London, and we told them that there are two main obstacles. One is your linkage to Israel, and the other one is your support to dictatorship. And we thought that they would have changed that, because I will just give you one example. In 1991, after the war in Kuwait, President Bush urged the Iraqis to rise up against Saddam Hussein.
Yes.
And then he immediately, once they rose,
that was a big mistake.
Yeah, he allowed Saddam Hussein to use force to this.
Because we were limiting the conflict
because
to
of the United Nations. One of the mistakes we're making now, I think, even in the current affair, is first off, just to answer your first point about looking into why we're not liked. I Rupert, I'm sure someone who's former MOD man will back me up on this. Governments work in their self-interest, not in popularity contests.
Yes.
So we do to what we feel our ends are, both in our self-interest and in defending freedom and democracy. So, you bring up Israel. Israel is a staunch ally, and I don't care what the rest
Bobby,
of the world
before
thinks.
We go down that route, let's check out some statistics to get a better idea of who and what the GCC is.
The Gulf Cooperation Council was created on 25th of May 1981 and covers the 630 million acre Persian Gulf states of Bahrain, Kuwait, Oman, Qatar, Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. The Gulf Cooperation Council resurrected the defunct Peninsula Jazeera Shield Force in 2009, prompted by Yemeni incursions into Saudi Arabia. It was rebranded and retooled as a Peninsula Shield Rapid Reaction Force, though questions as to whether it could ever function as a genuine multinational task force still remain. The arrival of 1,000 Saudi troops with armoured troop carriers and other assorted, lightly armed vehicles, plus the UAE and Qatari contingents, signify a qualitative shift in the dynamics of the troubles in Bahrain. Iran and Iraq are not part of the GCC, although both nations have a coastline on the Persian Gulf. Yemen is currently in negotiations for GCC membership and hopes to join by 2016, despite the fact that it has no coastline on the Gulf. The GCC Secretary General is Qatari-born Abdul Rahman bin Hamad Al Attiyah, who has held the role since 2002.
So, Saeed, is it an elite old boys club, or is the GCC a force for good?
Well, so far, I think the GCC has managed to reach some agreements on in economic and security arrangements, but it has failed on two important issues, or three, rather. I hope to remember them. First is the border disputes. It has so far not managed to do that. Still, there are problems between Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, between Kuwait and Saudi Arabia, and between Saudi Arabia and, of course, Yemen. Still, there are problems there. But also they failed on the shape of the political system. They are differing. You have in Kuwait some degree of democratization, while in Saudi Arabia you have totally backward reactionary regime. They have not also agreed on the issue of joint force. They had proposed what they call the defense strategy. Until now, they have not. And this, the Peninsula Shield was defunct, almost defunct. It was established in the 80s, but it went, it failed to even to shot one shot, to fire one shot against Saddam Hussein's forces when it occupied Kuwait in 1990. So this force has been almost non-existent. Until now, we saw it existing in the sense of invading Bahrain for internal repression and not against any external threat.
Well, I was going to say it's certainly in evidence now. Rupert, were you surprised at how quickly this force was assembled? Well, I think even Kuwait has joined in now on a naval capacity.
Yes, in terms of realpolitik, no. Plainly, the wind of change was blowing. It's worth remembering that even George Bush said one of the benefits of change of Iraq, maybe the democratization, will spread outwards throughout the Middle East. So it was an intended result, what's happening. Quite plainly, that wasn't popular. Bahrain is very small, Saudi is very large. They have a large number of weapons which they can't do much with, as you've pointed out, but they can do this. And,
but so the Saudi government is notorious for really overthinking, contemplating, spending a great deal of time before acting on anything, sometimes months and years.
Yes, but this really was its own backyard. This is its own backyard. And quite plainly, it didn't. It seems to me, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, Meir Yamani says here, the reality is the royal family was never under threat in Bahrain. The discussion. Dialogue would have been the way forward. There wasn't need for repression. They have been radicalized by repression. Now, that's weird. It's a weird thing to do, but it produces the result you want, provided you act quickly enough.
But again, I think it goes back to, and this is why it is so important, and people never understood this in the past, and I would argue of America as the superpower and American exceptionalism, which is a concept Mr. Obama doesn't seem to get. Janet Daly had a wonderful piece in the Sunday Telegraph about this, if one's able to get it online, was you have to show this consistency towards your allies, because again, they're saying, wait a minute, normally America would step into the breach here. Is Mr. Obama going to throw the Bahrainis or the Saudis?
There were so many hopes for Obama, and one of them was that he would behave differently from previous American administrations. But he has definitely done that.
That's been his mistake.
It is not. Yeah. It doesn't show strength, but it does show a willingness to let the world come to a point of view before intervening. He has now intervened, as indeed he's chosen to do in Afghanistan. He didn't withdraw from that. But he's given time for other people, including the United Nations, to come to a decision of what's wanted and then ask him, which is at least a different way of doing things.
But it's not showing that leadership and consistency. For instance, you know, from an American standpoint, there's been a lot of talk in the States, again, on both sides of the aisle, that he went to the UN without going to the Congress. Now, I don't think it's necessarily, there is a constitutional argument.
He's not required to go to the Congress about wars.
He is generally required.
It's become a convention, but it's not a requirement.
Well, there are certain circumstances, obviously, if one is attacked, he has a right. But the War Powers Act means he really does need to go to the Congress. And there was this sort of arrogance, if you will, of saying, well, I've gone to the UN, and Americans are saying, no, you don't work for the United Nations, you work for us, and the Congress is the sovereign body, not the United Nations.
That does show political leadership within his own brand of politics, which is apparently not yours.
Well, I mean, it's been played by the press and by certain circles. I'm not making accusations in your direction. That what's happened is essentially he dithered. But now many are trying to spin this and saying, oh, no, it wasn't dithering. Look at the beautiful nuance of what Mr. Obama has accomplished by stepping back.
Well, of course, that's the American perspective, but the international community have all reacted in different ways. And this single act of calling in foreign forces, even if they are allies, may well have turned King Hamad and other GCC leaders into social outcasts, according to some.
The King of Bahrain's decision to violently crush the pro-democracy movement in his country could turn him into a social outcast among his influential friends in the West. Speculation is already rife that he was disinvited from Prince William's royal wedding in London next month, although the official line is that he declined the invitation to avoid the embarrassment of protests outside Westminster Abbey. Now, other senior royals in the GCC countries, which sent forces into Bahrain, must be wondering if they might also be forced to abandon the West's social event of the year. Whatever the truth is, observers are shocked King Hamad bin Isa Al Khalifa has been forced to decline the invitation to the event, which is so exclusive. News of King Hamad's absence from the event came less than 48 hours after he invited foreign soldiers from neighboring Saudi Arabia to Bahrain to help stop the protests from pro-democracy campaigners in the tiny island state. They were joined by other forces from the UAE and Qatar. Feeling among Muslims and non-Muslims alike are running high, and last weekend saw large protests so far in London over the invasion of GCC troops into Bahrain. A sizable amount rallied at the Bahraini embassy before marching to the Saudi embassy. Police say the protest was peaceful, but the thought of thousands turning up on the day of the royal wedding could prove to be an additional security headache. The King of Bahrain and royals in other Persian Gulf states must now be wondering if their continued oppression of revolutionaries will turn them into social pariahs among their friends in the West.
Rupert, I would imagine that you got tied up in a lot of protocol in your time with the MOD, but is being disinvited from the royal wedding, is that a really serious blow, do you think?
Well, it depends on how it's seen. When there's a whole lot of other things going on, it's a question of how much it matters. Oh, yes, it's embarrassing. It requires an awful lot of changing. What they've been able to do, in fact, is swiftly shunt in some villagers from Kate Middleton's home village, which is actually very charming. But it means that there's been a certain amount of resetting of places to do. But that is vanishingly unimportant compared with what's happening in the Middle East.
I'm sure it hasn't gone down with the king's children.
No, right. You know? But I mean, this is so unimportant compared with the huge issue, which is that we shouldn't be making pariahs out of our current, not just former allies, but we should be encouraging people to talk when they are not behaving as Gaddafi is behaving, with bullets. We shouldn't start with bullets.
Well, they have already started with bullets.
I know.
From the very first day, on the 14th of February, the first demonstration took place, and the first victim fell. And then second day...
But did you expect that? As a potential was on the side of the demonstrators, did you not imagine that something similar to the velvet style of revolutions in Egypt and Tunisia would happen there?
Well, I thought, and especially we thought, that the Americans would stand by what they said, because we remember about 2 months ago when the revolution in Tunisia and in Egypt started, President Obama and Hillary Clinton both said that it is the right of people to demonstrate peacefully. And this is exactly what happened in Bahrain. Until today, nobody has accused the Bahraini people of committing any act of violence. They were encamped in a small square. And then I can assure you and can tell you that members of the American embassy were visiting the square, and they were entertained by the people there. I hear that, and I was told by very close friend there it was becoming more of a cultural festival rather than any...
But it is not the West that has invaded. It's the Saudis.
I think one worry that I would have, and again, I'm not basing this on any specific information, this is just personal thoughts, is revolutions don't necessarily turn out to be successful democracies. I think the United States has been one of the few real exceptions to the rule. And as much as I am someone who argues very much to overcome tyranny and to evolve to free societies and would support democratic movements, I'm not necessarily convinced that I've seen that in the Middle East. If, for instance, looking specifically at Egypt, that has been more inspired by the Muslim Brotherhood. A lot of my sources tell me that Iran's hand has been behind a lot of this. So, you know, I look at someone like yourself and I say, yes, you strike me as a true person who wants to evolve into a free and democratic society, a legitimate protester, a legitimate dissident, if you will. But I'm wondering if the Saudis and the Bahrainis and even the United States or others are saying, wait a minute, is this truly evolution by true dissidents, or are others getting in there? And one of my fears, again, looking to Egypt, is, and I've written about this, will it be robbed from a democratic movement and have one tyrant replaced with another, and to boot, a tyrant that won't necessarily be a friend to the West?
But you see, if we start from these assumptions, we always assume the bad guys will take over. Mm. I don't think our people, you see, this is a sign of, excuse me, not for you, but for others, arrogance, that usually the people, the Middle Eastern people, do not understand, they are backward, they are extremists, and if we give them the chance, they would always elect extremist elements to their governments. I don't think that is the case.
No, I don't think they necessarily would, but I think sometimes when democracies are at their most fragile, is when there are forces that want to take over, just as when you see the student protests here, you know, you've never seen a protest go off nicely. You know, it starts off peacefully with people with good intent, and then obviously you get this.
Oh, many protests. That's not fair. We have marches and the right
British
to protest.
But the British police did not use live ammunition on the students.
No, I mean, with protest and announcement of your opinion and presenting it is happens every week.
Oh, yeah, no, I agree. I'm just saying, I think one
it's
has
America
to make,
that's
hey, listen, no, I've been on protest marches.
What angers me most also is the blind eye that is being given to what has happened in Bahrain, in Tunisia, in Egypt. Only in Egypt it happened once, that these thugs came to the square on camels and on horses and attacked the demonstrators.
That was appalling, yes.
One day. Hmm. In Bahrain, it has been going for 3 weeks now. Right. And the thugs were hooded with swords, with axes, with steel bars, attacking and slashing, and we have hundreds.
Who are they? Are they agents of the government? Are they policemen in plain clothes?
They are militias. They have been there for a long time. And
let's
call
examine
them
exactly who these people are in the second half. We're hurtling towards a break now. But before we go, I want to know who said this.
We have made clear that security alone cannot resolve the challenges facing Bahrain. Violence is not the answer. A political process is.
Stay tuned for the answer right after the news. Welcome back to today's edition of The Agenda with me, Yvonne Ridley, and studio guests Syed Chahabi, Rupert Nicol and Charlie Wolfe. As we went into the break, I asked who said, we have made clear that security alone cannot resolve the challenges facing Bahrain. Violence is not the answer, a political process is. They were the words of US Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, who was speaking to reporters in Paris after meeting several Arab ministers recently. Saeed, that was quite a slight against the ruling Bahrain family, wasn't it?
Well, this is supposed to be something, a magical solution, in the sense that it would convince the royal family in Bahrain not to use force. But unfortunately, Not only that they did use force, but Hillary Clinton herself changed her tone later and what she said. And now what we hear from Washington is that countries have the right to maintain their stability and security. So as if justifying the use of sheer terror against unarmed civilians.
Why has there been this change in position by America? Because Ban Ki-moon was on the phone to Bahrain telling them to stop the government forces' violence. The EU minister, Catherine Ashton. She was also on the phone, Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International. Various different organizations have condemned the reaction of the government forces.
I think you'd have to ask the White House. Or possibly the State Department, or possibly the
Pentagon. Well, you're usually very good at second-guessing
unfortunately, in all seriousness, that's been part of the problem, is there has not been, out of this administration, a consistent line. The U.S. press, again, on both sides of the aisle, Democrat, Republican, left, right, no one knows where the White House stands. Gates was originally against action, for instance, in Libya. Hillary Clinton, and it seems it was Samantha Power, the advisor on national security affairs to the president, was behind some of this. We've had mixed messages. Hillary Clinton, there's been stories of being very frustrated. She is leaving at the end of 2012, whatever happens in the election. There's been no consistent position. We don't know if we're going in with regime change, not regime change. We're sort of in there, but we're not in there. It's a war, but it's not a war.
How influential is the friendship with Saudi Arabia?
I mean,
how influential is the friendship with Saudi Arabia? I mean, you've just signed a $20 billion arms deal for that region with Saudi.
It's hard to say. No one seems to understand Mr. Obama's thinking. He does not fall into classic modes of American foreign policy. George Bush was actually far more inconsistency, and even looking at, for instance, comparing, say, Iraq with Libya, he actually had more UN support, he actually had a far bigger coalition, and he had the approval, as he should have had, of the Congress.
How do you think George Bush would have handled this, seeing the images that we've seen on press TV and other stations of government forces opening up live ammunition on
crowds? Well, there would have been a lot more consistency, I think, from the start. That's the main message. I think he would have seen it coming a lot sooner. It surprises me that the administration and Jim Jones, I think it was, at NSC, did not see Egypt. Egypt seems to be, to me, more
than Tunisia wasn't seen to have been coming.
Yeah, but Egypt, more so than Tunisia, seems to be the crux here, the fulcrum. And it's interesting because the Saudis and the Israelis saw that coming about a year ago. NSC didn't, and they weren't prepared for it. State, Pentagon, no one seemed to have been prepared and had any sort of a line or a playbook or a scenario on what to do. I would hope that the Bush administration would have been a bit more prepared. And again, as Neil Ferguson has said recently, at least the Bush administration had an overarching policy. Rightly or wrongly, agree or disagree, didn't always live up to it either, but it went in with a strategy. Ferguson said recently on American television, and again, this is before Bahrain, this is more based around Egypt, he said, there is no foreign affairs experience in this White House, and there is no strategy whatsoever. There is no sort of agenda or overarching strategy, and that's the problem.
Do you feel as though that's happening, that the White House is sort of feeling its way around in the dark here?
Well, I'm not sure. I think they are. The White House is clearly under pressure from the Saudis, and that the Saudis and the rest of the GCC are putting pressure on them. And we have always thought that these GCC countries need to be reinvigorated as democracies, and we thought that the Americans and their allies would take the challenge of standing up to their allies and saying, look, the way you are going is only leading you towards more blackness and
the
problem.
Why did the GCC leaders not pick up the phone and tell King Hamad, pull back your forces, in the same way that we're told other world leaders did?
The GCC themselves are led by the by Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is the only country. I mean, I forget the GCC. There is no GCC. In reality, there is Saudi Arabia, which is bullying the others. It is the largest of all, and it is occupying their lands, and it is the one that has the largest force, and of course, it is the richest and the biggest. So they have about 15, 20 million, while the other GCC has 500,000 each or so. So we are under the domination and the subjugation by the Saudi regime. And this and the Saudis is the worst of all the regime of all those regimes in terms of human rights, democratization, public participation in power. So we had always thought that the United States would mature enough to stand up to its own ideals, that democracy is important and that reforms are necessary. Until today, we have heard today that they are going to have some municipal elections. Why? Because they say we want to train the Saudis to...
You only have to go back. You want to talk inconsistency. And again, I feel being in a bad place here, you know, on the one hand, it's our democratic right to criticize my president. It's something I can do that you obviously can't. But that said, you know, I'm sitting in foreign soil during, you know, essentially a foreign war. But, you know, the inconsistency goes right back to the Iranian elections, where here was this man who's supposed to be standing up to bring the world together and human rights and what have you, and he was off the mark on that. It wasn't for about 2-3 weeks that he spoke at all as far as people getting shot in the streets after the Iranian
elections.
But what
consistency are you looking for? Surely, to the extent that there has not been the interference or the complaints that you're asking for, he has shown at least a consistency towards a known ally and very important economic partner.
But I'm saying as far as Iran was concerned, but he didn't show that consistency to an ally as far as Egypt was concerned.
It's interesting that you mentioned Iran. But it's interesting you mention Iran because the latest WikiLeaks cables reveal that the U.S. ambassador in Bahrain has said quite clearly that these accusations of Iran interfering in Bahrain is a reflection of the paranoia of the ruling elite in Bahrain, and that there hasn't been any sort of interference there.
Well, I don't know, the sources I've heard would tend to go more to the other. Again, I'm not saying there aren't democratic movements, but we know Iran very much wants to interfere in the region.
Well, these were the views of the U.S. ambassador in Bahrain.
But interfere or assert itself?
Well, you can use whatever term you want.
Well,
I would consider it to be
We're going to get the public view now, and Mohammed Walji went for a riverside stroll in central London, and this is what he found.
I'm here in central London today to ask members of the public what they think about the situation in Bahrain and whether they think it's a foreign occupation. So let's hear what they had to say. When you saw 1,000 Saudi troops coming down the causeway to Bahrain, what were your thoughts?
My thoughts were they have no right to intervene. It's not their country, it's not their people, and the king said they're there to protect our people. Well, clearly they're not.
Well, at first I was thinking it's quite worrying that foreign troops are coming into Bahraini soil. I was worried simply because there was no popular mandate for this intervention as such. And it's very worrying to know that there was a simple and quick resort to military force. And although the protesters themselves hadn't used any strong force at all.
Do you think this is a foreign occupation?
Yes, I do, because Saudis are not Bahrainis and they're not there for the right reasons. They're just there to kill people and they're just ruining the country each day they're there.
I wouldn't call it an occupation as such, but essentially it could be, because it's actually just the dictators in Bahrain that have actually called in the Saudi forces to come in, not the Bahraini people. The Bahraini people don't want the Saudi forces in.
Why has the West intervened over the brutalization of Arab citizens in Libya, Egypt and Tunisia, but have remained silent over those in Bahrain?
I think in Bahrain the interests are very different. Of course, with Gaddafi in the first place in Libya, the West were completely cut off, and only until recently they started dialogue with him and opened up contracts and business. So it's not very hard for them to close Gaddafi off and take him out, basically.
A lot of that has to do with Bahrain having the US Navy's Fifth Fleet there, and they've got very strong alliances with Saudi Arabia and other Gulf states. So if they were to intervene in Bahrain, this would affect the other Gulf states, which have, I'm sure, the Americans and the British, in fact, have a lot of national interest to keep away from that, to protect their oil interests.
Do you see the arrivals of the Saudis as a foreign occupation? You know, the people that Mohammed spoke to did in the whole?
Yes, I thought they were remarkably articulate. They certainly seemed to know what they thought, and they seemed to have a pretty good idea about the realpolitik as well, about, you know, where interests lie, particularly economically and in oil. The fact remains that, well, again, I will quote Meir Yamani, the Gulf Cooperation Council was established after the outbreak of the Iran-Iraq war to protect the states from outside threats. It was never meant to be used for internal repression of its people or for neighbourly repression. Well, that says it clearly. It had a different function. It's been used for this purpose. It's very difficult to object because a very powerful state has asserted itself. And we can agree or disagree, but it's now happened. And I just hope that they will begin to start the dialogue. If you can, I don't think there was a need for repression.
Dialogue under the gun?
Well, we must stop the gun and start the talking. George or not war, war.
So you should, they should first withdraw, or do you think that we should talk while they are occupying our land?
You tell me whether there's a real serious threat to either the Bahraini government or the Bahraini monarchy. I don't think there can be. Therefore, but I mean, you might as well talk.
Can't you see that the Bahraini, the Al Khalifa, have relinquished their sovereignty by inviting others to come?
Well, bringing in people in aid, as has happened in many places.
To do what?
Well, in this, look, I don't support this. Mm. All I'm saying is, it is not unknown to bring in people in aid, and it's happened in Libya as well.
Part of peacekeeping forces.
Just to keep up to speed, what are the demands at the moment, the key demands at the moment of the protesters?
At the moment, the demands for years has been to engage in dialogue and improve and have a constitution written by the people. This was the case until the beginning of this revolution. And after that, there were attempts to have dialogue with the regime. Other people, they say, no, there is no room for negotiation. Now, after all what has happened, especially in the past 10 days, I don't think there is a mood to negotiate with the regime. It seems to me that most people,
at the moment you've got a stalemate.
There is a stalemate because it is not only from one side. I mean, when you see that the villages are encircled every night, when you see that Saudi troops are at every corner, when you see that roadblocks are at every village.
Well, unfortunately, we can't see that on press TV because our cameras were removed and confiscated. And we have been in touch, by the way, with the Bahrain Embassy in London to invite them onto the show and to comment on the points that have been raised here, and we're still waiting for that response. So if anyone from the Bahrain Embassy is watching, that is, please do contact us. But Charlie, do you see that this is a classic case where the international community is going to have to intervene and try and break the deadlock? Because if nothing's moving, I can't see how things are going to change.
Yeah, the international community doesn't have quite a great record of it if you're talking, for instance, United Nations. I mean, you only have to look at some of their peacekeeping operations in just even recent history. I'm not sure, quite sure what the answer is. I mean, there is, as Rupert said, there is realpolitik.
Yes.
I would hope, if anything, if the Saudis are keeping one side away from the other and keeping the peace, then hopefully it would give an atmosphere for people to sit down.
An opportunity for dialogue.
Are the Saudis keeping peace and are they inviting dialogue? What are the Saudis saying?
There was no military engagement so that to keep the two sides apart. There was one group, which is the people, calling for rights, and there was one active party which was engaged in brutalism, brutal force. So far about 25 people have been killed and maybe at least 2,000.
But is there any reason to stop talking? I mean, now, if...
Talk with whom? Talk with somebody who wants to uproot you. In the past 48 hours, the things that have happened, they have taken all the people who could talk into prison. They have imprisoned the leadership and also the activists.
What is the opportunity for moving towards a constitutional monarchy?
How can you move when they are in jail? You talk to whom?
Well, we start from where we are, and where we are is not good and can only get better through conversation, not bullets.
Yes. So first of all, let them remove all the foreign troops. Let them pull out the thugs.
Yeah, but now that's an excuse for not talking.
Yeah.
Talk about what and with whom? I mean, there's nobody to talk to. Everybody is in jail. I mean, the people who matter, those people, the main figures who were in jail only until 3 weeks ago.
As we know from Northern Ireland, it's possible to have discussions with people who are actually in jail. Yes.
And would you?
It does work. Well, we that was the negotiations that we achieved.
You see, then it becomes the justice of the victor, and it becomes a dictator.
No, because it went the way you would wish.
Well, and I'm going to come back to this. Yeah. It's fascinating about talking to the leaders in prison, but before we do that, let's head for the agenda's electronic post room, where Mohammed Walji selects the best Facebook responses to today's topic.
Thanks, Yvonne. Well, we always knew today's subject was going to be a hot topic, but the temperature in the Facebook debating forum reached boiling point almost immediately. Khalil Beg from the northwest of England didn't see the arrival of GCC troops as the invasion of a foreign power. He stormed, "Absolutely not. The soldiers are there to maintain stability and security, not to occupy. Bahrain remains under the leadership of the righteous king. The protesters are nothing but thugs. They have been attacking ambulances, beating innocents on the streets and blocking off neighbourhoods and engaging in sectarian fights. Saudi has no reason to occupy." And he went on and on and on. But Rezina Batul Shah in the UK was having none of it and replied, "That's the kind of stability that's killing innocent people." Ims H. Harrell from Pakistan was more puzzled as to why Bahrain was in need of Saudi help but Libya wasn't. Saudi GCC sent troops to help Bahrain's ruler, but not people being massacred by Gaddafi. Khalil Beg fired back, "There was no killing before the terrorists took to the Bahraini streets." That response drew rapid fire from Anissa Abdel Fattah, who is the founder of the National Association of Muslim American Women. She said, "Yes, Bahrain is under foreign military occupation, and the people have all of the rights conferred by the Geneva Conventions in such instances. If the foreign troops continue to attack, injure and kill people, we might expect a full-blown regional resistance movement." The difference of opinions prompted Khalil Beg to respond one more, predicting a sectarian conflict. But Anissa Abdel Fattah fired back, "The people are under military occupation and have a right to resistance by any means necessary." And it was at this point the discussion became too heated to repeat. Well, that's all we have time for today. So if you'd also like to be in touch, then please send your emails to theagenda@presstv.com. You can also contact us on Facebook or text us at +44 780 00 0806. If you'd like to watch a partial, simply go to our website at presstv.com. Once there, click on the programs icon, then click on the agenda panel, and there's a selection of partials for you to choose from. Thanks for watching, and back to you in the studio.
Thanks for that, Mohammed. Well, in the last few minutes, let's get our guests' concluding remarks. Charlie, do you see that there's a role here for Obama to play to try and bring both sides together, or is it something that he's not too bothered about at the moment?
He doesn't seem to be too engaged. He hasn't been too engaged in foreign policy, if you look back over the last 2 years of his presidency anyway. His has always been the domestic agenda, getting his health care. Actually, now he's locked down into election mode. He's thinking about 2012, so he's not going to do anything controversial. He's going to literally be on hold for as best as he can for the next 2 years, so there's nothing on his record. There's no controversies to worry about.
So you don't see any role for the Americans to play at the moment?
Well, you would think that there should be, and you would hope that there should be. Again, we are supposed to be the shining city on a hill that stands for freedom and democracy and wants to...
Well, that's what we're told about the military intervention in Libya.
Mm. And again, but that wasn't necessarily because of the Americans. He wasn't for that in the beginning. It was only once the French and the English, or the British, passed it, and it went to the United Nations, and Samantha Power and Hillary Clinton sort of bent his ear, the powerful
and
women.
And the Libyans asked for it.
Mm. Well, but even then, he was late in the mark.
Yes.
Rupert, what do you see the end game being here? I mean, there's quite clearly a stalemate.
It's a stalemate, and stalemates can go on for a very long time.
I mean, Saeed was saying that all of the spokespeople for the freedom movements are in prison.
Well, that's true, but I mean, you've got to start from where you are, and that's the difficult position we're in. You've got to try and break the logjam, which means discussion, not bullets. Otherwise, you've got yet another Middle East. You've got a Palestine situation.
So you would
on the
advise the royal family to go into the prison and sit down?
No, of course not. Discussions must be held. It must be understood what these people want. There must be a way. You can make the excuse that you've got the stable force. You've got to go with what you've got. So you have stability. Now let's talk. That's the way forward.
Just very briefly. If this thing goes on for a long time, which I think it will, especially as far as Libya is concerned, then you can definitely say that Mr. Obama will be serving one term.
Hmm. Right, okay. Obviously, you're not that concerned about how long Obama's in the White House, more about what's happening in Bahrain. What do you see the short-term solution is, and what is going to happen in the long term?
Well, I don't think there is a short-term solution. The only short-term solution will be imposed by the regime that we have taken all the troublemakers, put them, locked them behind cells, and it will try to maybe do some its own, say, constitution, impose a constitution, some elections. But I think on the long term, the ruling family will go. I think that it will go because regardless of the Saudi...
Are the protests going to continue?
Well, the zeal of the people today is much more than it was a week ago because of what they saw. I mean, they just realized that they cannot coexist with this ruling family. This ruling family is not the same as the ones in the other GCC countries. It's completely different. It came from outside, it conquered the land by force, and it treated the people as slaves, and it has occupied, until now, it is occupying more than 60% of the land and 90% of the seashores. So in that, the people of Bahrain view it as an invader in the same way as it views the Saudi occupiers.
Well, on that note, that just remains for me to say a very big thank you to all of you for taking part in what has been a riveting debate, and we'll see you all soon on the next agenda.